Mud Podcast presents.
Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes and I'll be with you until 10 a.m. Well, support for KMUD comes from Soham Health Garberville Optometry, now serving Southern Humboldt with its mobile optometry unit, offering eye exams, screenings, and treatment for eye-related conditions. Glass fittings and contact lenses are also available, and they're open Tuesday through Thursday behind Garberville Pharmacy. More info at sohamhealth.org/optometry or 707-923-3922. Well, I opened with the young buffalo horse, also known as YBH, and they gave us Woman Warriors from their CD that translates to Sincerity in Action. Well, you know, a few things have happened about alligator Alcatraz. I reported on a couple of weeks ago, and there was a ruling in favor of the indigenous people, but you heard very little about it. You know, oh, but there was a ruling, okay, they can't keep building. That was it. you know, maybe on the mainstream media. It was very said a lot on all the native media. So I thought I'd share it with you in case you didn't hear. But a federal judge halted further construction on the notoriously dubbed Alligator Alcatraz Detention Center in response to a lawsuit citing the prison's risk to environmental diversity and Native American heritage. In addition to threatening endangered species like the Florida panther and bonneted bat, the prison impinges on the Miskosukee tribe's deep cultural and spiritual connections to the land surrounding the Dade Collier Training and Transition Airport, where the detention center was built, the lawsuit argues. There are 15 active traditional villages in the Big Cypress National Preserve, according to the tribe, which says that many of its ceremonial sites and burial grounds are situated in the area. A total of 10 Miskosukee villages are located within a 3-mile radius. One of them, the Panther Osceola Camp, where tribal members regularly host cultural activities and sacred ceremonies, is approximately 1,000 feet from the detention center's boundaries. The wetlands and swamps of Big Cypress are considered sacred to members of the tribe who were forced deeper into the Everglades in the 19th century and view the region as a sanctuary. And far from, quote, an uninhibited wasteland for alligators and pythons, as some have suggested, the area has long been populated and stewarded by the Miskosukee, with said a statement from the tribes shared with Hyperallergic. Quote, The Miskosukee tribe is committed to ensuring that our ancestral lands in Big Cypress will not become a permanent detention facility, Miskosukee Chairman Talbert Cypress said in a statement. The lawsuit was originally brought by three organizations, Friends of the Everglades, the Center for Biological Diversity, and Earth Justice, which accused local and federal authorities of breaking the law by forging ahead with the prison's construction without conducting an environmental impact study. And on July 14th, the Miskosukee tribe filed a motion to intervene in the suit, further claiming that Alligator Alcatraz was built without tribal consultation. The detention facility was erected in the heart of the tribe's ancestral lands, where, quote, hundreds if not thousands of protected ceremony and religious sites are located, the tribe said in its interventor complaint. Light and noise pollution, vehicle traffic, and other factors pose serious harm to the region's wetlands and ecosystem and could have adverse effects on potable water, according to court documents. These disruptions also interfere with the tribe's right to use the land, including for religious ceremonies and medicinal practices, as enshrined in the Everglades National Park Act and the Miskosukee Reserved Area Act. Activist and educator Betty Osceola, a member of the Miskosukee tribe, spoke to a group of people in the area. Also, community advocates and tribal members mobilized quickly against Alligator Alcatraz since Governor Ron DeSantis seized the defunct jetport under an emergency executive order in June. The cause has notably galvanized artists in and near the region, among them Artist for Artist, a Miami-based group hosting workshops and direct actions to, quote, counter state-sponsored dehumanization. And on July 13th, Big Cypress photographers Clyde and Nikki Butcher opened the doors to their gallery along the Miami Trail, less than 10 miles from the detention center, for a public event during which environmental organizations and the Miskosukee tribe member, activist, and educator Betty Osceola emphasized the region's biological diversity and ancestral significance. And the temporary injunction issued by Judge Kathleen Williams of the District Court for the Southern District of Florida pauses further building activity, including paving, fencing, and excavation on the site for the next 2 weeks. The order, however, does not suspend operations at the tented facility, where hundreds of detainees face what have been described as inhumane conditions made worse by life-threatening flooding and mosquito infestations. A separate civil rights lawsuit against the facility alleges that detainees are being imprisoned without charges and blocked from meetings with lawyers. Quote, this development, while promising, unfortunately, doesn't stop the camp or its use. However, it is a good example of how the camp might be closed permanently in the near future through environmental advocacy, which was the collective activist effort that stopped the jetport from being finished back in the 1970s. Michael Soto of Artists for Artists Miami said, quote, this is one of the tactics we're looking to throw our weight behind in the near future. Yeah, as if this 47's, the way he's running things, you know, actually gives a damn about anything that has to do with the environment. I want to share this with you now also.
Hello, everyone, friends and relatives. It's Tokata Ironize, spokesperson with Lakota People's Law Project. Today, I wanted to talk to you about my father and I's trip to the traditional lands of the Seminole peoples. And unfortunately, the day that we arrived was the same day as these horrible fires that were happening on the Miccosukee Reservation, and their cultural center was unfortunately burned to the ground. This is where the people would gather to do their traditional crafts, sewing their patchwork skirts and making new contemporary fashions. The Seminole tribe of Florida and the Miccosukee are of the same people, a lot like how the Lakota are split up amongst many reservations. And we got to visit both and see the very beautiful homelands of these peoples. We also had the grave experience of going to Alligator Alcatraz, and it's super insane to see the signs along the highway as you get closer and closer. And just to be able to see, I think visually, like alligators, you know, in the swamp, and just how rough the terrain is. I mean, for those of you who don't know the history of the place, in Florida, at least, the tribal nations there were able to survive so long by retreating into the swamp. And because it is such a hard climate and landscape to survive in, colonists were hard pressed to enter. And so it became very much a safe haven for the Seminole people and a sanctuary for them and their ways of life. Aside from the project of Alligator Alcatraz being completely immoral and inhumane, there has been zero environmental impact statement done. There was zero tribal consultation, and it's completely illegal, seeing as it's being built on unceded Seminole territory. The Seminole have fought for their treaty rights before and have won. We should be looking to them, the traditional caretakers of these lands. That is their sacred territory, and they say that they do not want it. So I thank the Miccosukee for making a stand and for making their voices heard, and more of us need to be able to do that with them. They've recently won a lawsuit to stay the ongoing construction of Alligator Alcatraz, and this is a temporary win. But our relatives in Miccosukee need help, and our relatives being detained by ICE in Alligator Alcatraz need our voices to be louder and louder. We are talking about basic human dignity and keeping people in such deplorable conditions, no matter where they come from or what they're perceived to have done. It is completely inhumane. Thank you.
Big alligator, he's mysterious. Big alligator, he's amphibious. Big alligator, he's dangerous. but with a big alligator, you can be prosperous. I was raised in the swamp by my old grandpa. We ate turtle meat, a fish called gar. Grandpa told me about panthers and bears, but most of all, he told me to beware about Halpati Chubi Nakshunichkika. Halpati Chubi Okinkeiwa. Halpati Chubi Hinokajijiwa. Halpati Chubi Himajajiwa. As days of the summers grew longer and hot, Grandpa took me on my first gator hunt. We pushed through sawgrass and willow sloughs with a big yellow dog in a dugout canoe. The dog started sniffing something in the air. Grandpa said, must be gator over there. Better grab your knife and some rope. And remember what I told you when you was a boy. Halpati chubi nachunichkika. Halpati chubi okinkiwa. Halpati chubi inubajijiwa. By the age of 12, I was sure of myself. I could catch alligators by myself. But my dog didn't know what my grandpa said. He jumped in the water by the gator's head. Halpati Chubi didn't even pause. My dog disappeared in the gator's jaws. I can still hear my grandpa saying, Halpati Chubi Nakshunichkiga. Halpati Chubi Okinkeiwa. Halpati Chubi Hinogajijiwa. Halpati Chubi Himajajiwa. Halpati Chubi Nakshunichkiga. Halpati Chubi Okinkeiwa. Halpati Chubi Hinogajijiwa. Halpati Chubi Himajajiwa. Many years later, I remember that day, how the big bull gator swallowed my dog. Scars and pain haunts my life, but I've learned to live, I learned to survive with Halpati Chubi Nakshunichkiga. Halpati Chubi Okinkeiwa. Halpati Chubi Hinogajijiwa. Halpati Chubi Himajajiwa. Halpati Chubi Nakshunichkiga. Halpati Chubi Okinkeiwa. Halpati Chubi Hinogajijiwa. Halpati Chubi Himajajiwa. Halpati Chubi, Halpati Chubi, Halpati Chubi, Hal.
And that was Chief Jim Billy from the Seminole Nation from his CD Alligator Tales. You heard Big Alligator. And I actually met him many years ago when I was in Albuquerque for the NAMI Awards. It's like the Grammys, but for Native musicians. And I was near the front, and all of a sudden, you know, he's coming down, and my Lord, he had a big alligator. I mean, this thing was huge. I mean, probably 10 feet long. There were these people carrying it. And I actually got to touch it. So I remember, wow. Well, I was absolutely mind blown over the weekend when I was seeing some news. And it was about, you know, what's his name, Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, and his pastor. And this guy is supposed to be some, you know, reverend, I guess. But the things he was saying against women, how they're just there to, you know, to give birth, to, that's all, you know, and they should not vote. We need to, you know, women should not vote. And, I mean, I had to remember that this is 2025. And I also remember that, you know, you hear these things that, you know, Trump's people want to do, and they actually do them. They try to do them. And so by the time I stopped cursing in every possible way, the very first thing that came into my mind is the story of after when the settlers arrived and they wanted to make some kind of, you know, deal or, you know, pact with the Native people. So they called a meeting. So the Native chiefs came with their women, because the chiefs make decisions, but not without the guidance of the women. And when they got there, all they saw were white men. And the first words out of the Native people's men's mouth was, "Where are your women? Where are your women?" That's the first thing that came into my mind. I said, okay, now I know what I'm going to talk about on Wednesday on Heart of the Earth. And I was going to start doing research. I have a bunch of books. And then Julie Francella posted on her Substack, "Women Led Here First," and I realized she did all the research for me. Thank you, Julie. This is an incredible piece, and I'm going to share it because it is just, I mean, it's so outrageous. And she says, last week, Fox News host and current Trump Defense Secretary appointee Pete Hegseth publicly endorsed his church pastors who teach that women should not vote. Not shouldn't have, past tense, but shouldn't, present tense. Their sermons talk about, quote, male headship and wives needing to be led, quote, with a firm hand. It's the same church profiled in a 2021 Vice investigation that showed how these teachings aren't just fringe. They're spreading through Christian nationalist networks with political reach, not in 1825, not in 1925, in 2025. And for some, this might sound absurd, an impossible step backwards, but history tells us these movements don't grow in the dark. They thrive when people dismiss them as too extreme to matter. The idea that women in political leadership is, quote, unnatural is not an ancient tradition. In fact, here on Turtle Island, the opposite is true. Long before the women's rights movement took hold in North America, long before suffragists marched through Washington in white dresses and sashes, women were already leading. Not quietly, not behind the scenes, openly, publicly, powerfully. Among the Hanandasi Confederacy, what many still call the Iroquois, women held political authority not as a symbolic gesture, but as a formalized system of governance. Clan mothers called Yakoyaners were responsible for choosing chiefs, guiding consensus, and holding the ultimate power to remove any leader who failed to act in the interest of the people. Land was passed through the women's line. Families were rooted in her clan. Spiritual and legal balance flowed through her voice. This wasn't a romanticized ideal. This was a functioning democracy that predates the U.S. Constitution, and it is still active when the first suffragists were finding their voice. And among them, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott and Matilda Jocelyn Gage, early architects of the suffrage movement, took notice. These non-Indigenous women, often credited with bringing, quote, radical ideas of equality into the mainstream, had spent time among the Hanandasi women and witnessed a living model of gender parity. Matilda Jocelyn Gage, in particular, was outspoken in her admiration. She was even adopted into the Mohawk Wolf Clan, honored for her advocacy, and wrote extensively about the Hanandasi governance, women's property rights, and spiritual equality. The Hanandasi were not alone. Across Turtle Island, many Indigenous nations practice matriarchy or balanced leadership models where women guided decision-making, held legal authority, and protected their communities, not through domination, but through relational care and inherited responsibility. And while settler governments imposed patriarchal law, suffragists had already seen examples of Indigenous systems where women's leadership was embedded into the structure of governance. And while the women's suffrage movement borrowed legitimacy from these Native societies, Indigenous women were largely excluded from the benefits of the 19th Amendment in 1920. Native people were not recognized as U.S. citizens until 1924, and even then, states found ways to keep them from voting through poll taxes, literacy tests, and open racism. In Canada, First Nations people could not vote in federal elections without giving up treaty rights until 1960. In 1913, Métis Ojibwe activist Marie-Louise Bonteno Baldwin marched in the women's suffrage procession in Washington, D.C. in full regalia. She was a lawyer, a Bureau of Indian Affairs employee, and an unapologetic presence among mostly settler suffragists, a reminder that Native women did not need to be granted rights to be leaders. Zitkala Sa, a Yankton, Dakota writer and educator, co-founded the National Council of American Indians and fought for both citizenship and voting rights for Native peoples. She called out the hypocrisy of celebrating suffrage while Native people were denied citizenship. She knew the ballot was not the gold. It was a tool and only as powerful as the justice it served. This history is not an accessory to the women's movement. It is root on this continent. When we remember that Indigenous women once held and still hold political authority, we begin to reframe our understanding of power. Klan mothers removed leaders not out of ambition, but out of sacred responsibility to the people. Leadership was built on accountability, consensus, and care, not ego. That matters right now because in 2025, Pete Hegseth reposted and praised a video featuring pastors from his church that calls for repealing women's voting rights and limiting the ballot to male heads of households. One pastor asserted that women should submit to their husbands, that they don't belong in combat leadership, and that democracy has strayed from, quote, Christian principles. As defined by this church, those principles place men as the sole decision makers in politics, the military, and the home, while women are told their highest calling is obedience. Christian nationalist frameworks like the one Hegseth endorsed interpret scripture in the ways that reject women's authority in any public sphere. They oppose reproductive rights, LGBTQ2S+ rights, and often resist the separation of church and state. The model they promote is a return to a patriarchal, quote, biblical order, one where civic and domestic life are both under male control. This is not an ancient universal truth. It is a selective, modern, political construction, one that directly opposes the governance traditions of many Indigenous nations. So where we go from here? Power is not lost all at once. It is chipped away. Erasing history is one of the first tools used to justify that erosion. And while people forget that women have led successfully for centuries on this land, it becomes easier to argue they shouldn't lead at all. So when leaders publicly say women should not vote or that votes belong to...
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Klan Mother's Power and the Suffrage Connection, the National Park Service article, How Native Women Inspired the Women's Rights Movement. Boy, I wonder how long that's going to be there. Okay, Marie-Louise Bonneau Baldwin and Zitkala Sa, National Park Service and National Women's History Museum profiles, the Canadian Suffrage Exclusion and the Indian Act, UBC Indigenous Foundations, the Gertrude Simmons Bonneau Zitkala Sa, Advocate for Indian Vote, Matilda Jolson Gage Foundation, and the AP News, U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth endorses church that says women should not vote.
The future is Indigenous women.
Just getting started, and there's nothing they can do to top us or drop us, beat us or block us, cause 500 years of genocide couldn't stop us. Look into the dictionary and you'll see the definition of Indigenous resilience. This is Native women, my great 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 grandmother's vision. They tried to stamp it out, but the phoenix is risen.
From the beginning, trust your medicine, you were chosen to wake. Shore Lenape or Citizen Potawatomi. Illuminate the space with our indigenosity. Like cedar smoke we rise tight like tobacco ties. Like stars in the sky we are beings of light. With our kin by our side we walk with love and pride. Changing the world one prayer at a time.
Native women, indigenous women, keepers of the heartbeat, keepers of the rhythm. Native women, indigenous women, we've been right here from the beginning. Trust your medicine, you were chosen to wake up medicine in the earth. You're the return of your ancestors. Know your power and know your way. Made of earth and the stars above. Ancestral strength inside your blood. A reflection
and never feel alone, cause there is lightning in your veins and there is thunder in your bones. The stars shine brighter, the darker the sky. The future is Native women. You were made for these times. So Two-Spirit women, Afro-Native women, undocumented women, yes, all my Native women, stand firm for the land, stand firm for the children, stand firm for the visions of the world that you're bringing. Yeah,
Native women, indigenous women, we deserve to heal. The trauma is not our fault. We've got a higher purpose here.
And that was Lila June, Native Women. Well, in Ecuador, where my family lives and where I'm from, my family's from, it was, you know, it almost seemed unbelievable, you know, when they said their Ecuador was going to be, you know, eco, and it was going to be green. And they passed all these laws to help the indigenous people in the Amazon of Ecuador. And it turns out it's just all, yeah, beep, beep. They're ignoring the laws, doing incredible destruction, and they're trying to get away with it. Oh, my gosh, what they want to do is beyond words. So I thought I'd share with you what's happening in Colombia, just north, because everyone thinks, you know, oh, Colombia, it's gotten, you know, they got rid of all the cartels, it's all nice now. Well, indigenous NASA children are gently splashed with water using a leafy branch, a ritual meant to protect them and symbolically, quote, open the path before setting off with wooden signs that they had painted with the messages like, we were born to protect the environment. And peace, please. Wearing protective gloves, the children nail their signs to trees lining a dirt road still used at times by armed groups for drug trafficking as they collect trash from land their families reclaimed from vast industrial sugarcane plantations in Colombia's conflict-scarred Southwest. This is no ordinary schoolyard activity. It's a quiet act of defiance and a hands-on lesson in protecting land and culture. Just beyond the reclaimed land of the indigenous Lopez Adendro Reserve near the town of Caloto, a sprayed-painted warning on a wall orders drivers to keep their windows rolled down or risk being shot. It's to allow armed groups to see inside. Roadside banners declare support for dissident factions of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, the leftist guerrilla group that signed a peace agreement with the government almost a decade ago. Violence in Caqua and many other regions has intensified since 2016 peace deal as criminal groups and FARC break away factions, fight for territory and control over lucrative drug trafficking routes once held by the demobilized rebels. And yes, they are using Ecuador. Ecuador used to be this little like island in the middle of, they, you know, they had no drugs being grown there, going through there. And all of a sudden, overnight, It has become just a hellhole. The drugs, the routes. I mean, they've even taken over some places in the Galapagos Islands. So think about that when you think about some of the drugs you're going to buy. Think about what it's doing to people, indigenous people in particular. To continue, the Children's Semillero, a weekend school where indigenous youth are nurtured like seeds, prepares the next generation to protect their ancestral land. More than a classroom, it's a space for learning, resistance, environmental care, and cultural pride. Their work echoes a broader community effort to restore damaged territory and preserve identity in a region still marketed by conflict. Daniela Secu, a 26-year-old coordinator and leader of the Semillero, said such training is essential as young people face so many challenges in their homeland. Quote, without alternatives, some end up drawn to armed groups, but here we teach them to protect the land through respect and care, not conflict, Secu said. Quote, we want them to learn our history and know they have a role in defending our territory. This is their inheritance. In 2019, dozens of Nasa families forcibly reclaimed nearly 350 hectares, that's about 865 acres of land, in northern Kaka that had been planted with sugarcane for years. The industrial monoculture had exhausted the soil and polluted water supplies with agrochemicals. The family's removal of sugarcane marked a turning point, transforming degraded fields into plots for corn, rice, cassava, beans, and plantains, alongside areas for forest regeneration and small-scale livestock raising. And I want to interject here because, you know, everybody loves their sugar, but you have to know about the sugar plantations. You know, 10 days ago we had a 3-day reggae festival. The music comes from Jamaica. If you ever go to Jamaica, you should check out the sugar plantations. How do you think all those Jamaican, the black Jamaicans, and there's some from India, they brought them too as slaves for the sugar plantations all along the Caribbean, South America, slaves for your sugar. To continue, the children wrapped up their signposting near an old finca, a rural estate once owned by a powerful sugarcane landlord. Faded FARC graffiti still marks the outer walls, a remnant of years of armed conflict. But today, a flag bearing the red and green of the Nasa people flies near it. The building, now crumbling and abandoned, is a dilapidated testament to the violence this land had endured. Children play on old sandbags left behind by the military during a recent occupation meant to repress the community's efforts to reclaim the territory. The family's 2019 takeover of the territory saw them arriving with machetes and cutting down the vast sugarcane crops, which are used to produce sugar, ethanol, and panela, a traditional unrefined sugarcane often sold in solid blocks and widely consumed across Colombia. Colombia has taken steps to empower indigenous groups, but land takeovers like the one in López Adentro has sparked controversy with critics, especially from agribusiness and government sectors, arguing that such occupations violate property rights and risk fueling further conflict. I mean, I had to really kind of laugh about the property rights. Okay. While indigenous communities describe the actions as legitimate reclamation of ancestral land, the national government has warned that land reform must follow legal channels and condemned unauthorized occupations. Yeah, what legal channels did you use when you took the land to begin with? Well, members of the Indigenous Guard say birds and other wildlife have returned to the area that was once only sugarcane. Yet the struggle is far from over. The community has endured forced evictions, military occupation, and threats from paramilitary groups. One resident, Carmelina Camayo, 49, remembers when the soldiers occupied the old finca for 3 years. Though the military withdrew in 2024, the threat of eviction looms once more, with the landowner preparing new legal action. Quote, we didn't survive all this to give up now, Camayo said. Quote, we have to continue resisting. The Semolero's work embodies that resistance. Sekou said it's not only about healing a land, but reclaiming identity. Many former Semolero members have grown to become leaders within the Indigenous Guard, protecting both people and territory. Quote, in a region where youth are vulnerable to violence and recruitment, we offer a different path, one of responsibility, belonging, and connection to our ancestors, Sekou said. And for families like Sekou's and Kameo's, hope rests on the next generation. Quote, we recover land so our children can eat from it and live on it, Kameo says. Quote, even when we are gone, they will know what they belong to. was Nuevas Raíces, yeah, traditional music of the Andes. I'm going to share this with you. It's from Levi Rickert of National Native News Online. And he says, I spent time with 5,000 of my relatives last week at the Gun Lake Reservation in western Michigan. We celebrated being Potawatomi and witnessed tribal leaders make history. The occasion, call it a massive family gathering, was a 2025 Potawatomi gathering hosted by the Mach-E-B Nash Shewish Band, commonly known as the Gun Lake Tribe. The out-of-state visitors experience what we Michiganers are used to during the dog days of summer, weather that changes almost instantly with hot, humid days from Lake Michigan, sudden rainfalls, and then comfortable temperatures under blue skies. Some of the Potawatomi relatives from Oklahoma and Kansas remarked they couldn't believe how green western Michigan is. The first gathering of the Potawatomi Nations was held in 1994, hosted by the Washusig First Nation in Prairie Sound, Ontario. It marked the inaugural Pan-Potawatomi cultural gathering, bringing together members from tribal bands from the United States and Canada to revitalize language, heritage, and identity. And since then, with the exception of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Potawatomi have met for annual gatherings. And each year, gatherings rotates between the various bands of the Potawatomi Nations, allowing to visit various reservations and meet with their counterparts in different parts of both the United States and Canada. The gatherings are filled with cultural exchange, language workshops, entertainment, and powwows. And additionally, work gets done as tribal councils from the various tribes meet to discuss joint concerns the tribes have with governmental policies and ways to promote economic development. Well, on Thursday, in an historic moment, the Potawatomi tribal leaders officially formed the Bondewadme Confederation of Tribal Nations by signing Articles of Confederation. The event comes after decades of dialogue. The document brings together the Potawatomi tribes as a singular block that has not existed since the tribes are broken up through land distribution by both the United States and Canadian federal governments in the 1800s. This formal unification followed a 2023 vote by leaders to create the Confederacy, a decision made during that year's gathering hosted by the Natawa Sepe Huron Band of the Potawatomi. And the preamble of the Articles of Confederation affirms the tribe's ancestral rights and inherent sovereignty, establishing the Confederation to secure a future as self-determined, self-governed nations. It emphasizes shared values such as tribal sovereignty, cultural preservation, and collaborative progress. And under Article 5, the Confederation's responsibilities include promoting economic development, environmental protection, cultural preservation, and political advocacy member nations. The signing ceremony was led by Gun Lake Tribe Chairman Bob Peters, who called the formation an historic moment, decades in the making. Peters emphasized the Confederation's potential to use collective power in negotiations with governments and vendors, particularly around economic development. And if you didn't get what this is all about, yes, the Canadian and U.S. government broke up the tribe into all the, you know, all the different bands, and they have finally come together and made themselves one band. To continue, quote, today was really historic. It was many years in the making, well before my time, Peters said to Native News Online. Quote, I've heard the stories from the chairman of my tribe and my family. I attended Potawatomi gatherings as a little guy, and at the time, and I didn't know what it was about. It felt like a large family reunion, but there's a lot that goes into family reunions. It's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, literally, for all of us, the 12 Potawatomi tribes. Known as the, quote, keepers of the three fires, the Potawatomi are a strong and resilient people. Last week, I interviewed Hannahville Indian Community Tribal Chairperson Kenneth Mishagod, who serves as his tribe's chairperson for almost four decades. Mishagod reflected emotionally on the moment, calling it the fulfillment of decades of effort to reunify the Potawatomi people under a shared vision. quote, as keepers of the fire, it's our responsibility to pass on the traditions and teachings of our culture to our people, whether they're young, old, or somewhere in between. Everyone has the ability to teach and become keepers of the fire, and the fire is within us. That's what we have to continue. My tribal chairman, Prairie Band of Potawatomi Nations, Joseph Zeke Rupnik, highlighted how united buying power, such as negotiating better deals for tribal casinos, could benefit all member nations. He also emphasized the importance of restoring cross-border trade and legislative collaboration between the U.S. and Canadian tribes. The formation of the Potawatomi Confederation of Tribal Nations will strengthen the Potawatomi people in the areas of economic development and as a political entity, similar to how the Coalition of Large Tribes, COLT, does for other tribes that have common concerns and interests. The Potawatomi gathering allows the Bodewami to celebrate who they are. Personally, attending the gathering allowed me the opportunity to celebrate being Potawatomi. And last week reminded me of something that happened to me 4 years ago when I stood across the Chicago River in downtown Chicago and saw Andrea Carlson's mural. It read, Potawatomiik, and in that language, it translates, you are on Potawatomi land in English. The pride of being Potawatomi as I stood there remains with me 4 years later. Last week, I experienced those same feelings. And again, that's from Levi Rickard. I'm going to end the show with some Potawatomi songs, but I just wanted to share part of this poem that is from Robert Bordeaux's new book called Prairie Bones. He's Lakota, and he's relearning his language. And it says, I saw an eagle fly over I-70. I whispered to myself, Wombly. There is so much I do not know, I do not yet know. But with every word I learn in Lakota, I think about what it will sound like, hearing my children say them back to me. I think about how my ancestors will get to hear the future generation's children they prayed for speak in their tongue, and that alone carries me forward every tomorrow. Think about that. Think about what we're teaching our children. Yes, 10 days ago at Reggae on the River, I saw 3 and 4 generations of families. And when we first started, we had all those little kids running around. They're all grown up now. And they've brought back the festival with their children. Hearing children ask questions to Julie and Marley in the press tent was just, it brought tears to my eyes. Because this community is sharing that. That's one thing we have here. So I thank you all for that. Yes, I'm going to close with the Potawatomi song. Yeah, Beautiful Way of Life. I'll be back next week. And this is the Big Soldier Creek drum group.
This has been a K-Mite podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.